the fuck is going on?
Sir, we had a launch transient dead aft.
Sonar, con, what else do you have?
Nothing, sir. Nothing after the transient.
That was a launch transient. HP air into the water, but...
Sounded a little funny, sir.
I show nothing in the water.
Right fore rudder, the OOD ordered, ignoring the captain. He hadn't been relieved yet, and conning the boat was his responsibility.
Make your depth 100 feet. 5-inch room. Launch a decoy now, now, now.
Right fore rudder, aye.
Sir, my rudder is right full, no course given. Speed 20 knots and accelerating, helmsman said.
Very well. Come to course 010.
Aye, coming to new course 010.
Who's in this area? The CO asked in a relaxed voice, though he didn't feel relaxed.
Main's around here somewhere, the navigator answered.
Harry Ricks. That asshole, he didn't say. It would have been bad for discipline.
Sonar, talk to me.
Con, sonar, there is nothing in the water.
If there was a torpedo, I'd have it, sir.
Nav, drop speed to 1/3.
Aye, all ahead 1/3.
I think we scared the piss out of him, Ricks observed, hovering over the sonar display. Seconds after the simulated launch, the 688 on the scope had floored his power plant, and now there was also the gurgling sound of a decoy.
Just backed off on the power, sir. Blade count is coming down.
Yeah. He knows there's nothing after him now. We'll give him a call on the Gertrude.
That dumbass.
Doesn't he know that there may be an Akula around here? The commanding officer of the USS Omaha growled.
We don't show him, sir. Just a bunch of fishing boats.
Okay. Secure from general quarters. We'll let Maine have her little laugh.
He grimaced.
My fault. We should have been trolling along at 10 instead of 15 knots.
Make it so.
Aye, sir. Where to?
The boomer ought to have a feel for what's north of here.
Go southeast.
Right.
Nice reaction, Nav. We might have evaded the fish.
Lessons?
You said it, sir. We were going too fast.
Learn from your captain's mistake, Mr. Auburn.
Always, sir.
The skipper punched the younger man's shoulder on the way out. 36,000 yards away, the Admiral Lunan was drifting at 3 knots just over the thermoclin layer, her towed array sonar drooping under it.
Will? Her captain asked.
We heard this burst of noise at 130, the sonar officer said, pointing to the display. And nothing else. 15 seconds later, we have another burst of noise here, ahead of the first. The signature appears to be an American Los Angeles class going to full power, then slowing and disappearing off our screens.
An exercise, Yevgeny. The first transient was an American missile submarine, an Ohio class.
What do you think of that?
Captain First Rank Valentin Borisovich Dubinin asked.
No one has ever detected an Ohio in deep water.
For all things, there is a first time.
And now?
We will hover and wait. The Ohio is quieter than a sleeping whale, but at least we know now that there is one in the area. We will not chase after it. Very foolish of the Americans to make noise in this way. I've never seen that happen before.
The game has changed, Captain, the sonar officer observed.
It had changed quite a lot. He didn't have to say, Comrade Captain, anymore.
Indeed it has, Yevgeny. Now it is a true game. No one need get hurt, and we can test our skills, as in the Olympics.
Critique? I would have closed a little before shooting, sir. The weapons officer said. Even money, he might have evaded that one.
Agreed.
But we were only trying to shake him up, Rick said comfortably.
Then what was the purpose of that exercise?
Dutch Claggett wondered.
Oh, of course. To show how aggressive you are.
I guess we accomplished that, the XO said to support his captain. There were grins all around the control room. Boomers and fast attack subs often played games, mostly pre-planned. As usual, the Ohio had won this one, too. They'd known that Omaha was around, of course, and that she was looking for a Russian Akula that the P-3s had lost off the Aleutians a few days before. But the Russian Shark-class sub was nowhere to be heard. OOD, take her south. We went and made a datum with that launch transient. We'll clear datum back down where Omaha was.
Aye, aye, sir.
Well done, people. Ricks walked back to his cabin. New course? South, Dubinin said. He'll clear datum by going into the area already swept by the Los Angeles. We'll maintain position just over the layer, leave our tail under it, and try to reacquire. There wasn't much chance, the captain knew, but fortune still favored the bold. Or something like that. The submarine was due to go back to port in another week, and supposedly the new sonar array she was due to receive during her scheduled overhaul was a major improvement over the current one. He'd been here south of Alaska for 3 weeks. The submarine he'd detected, USS Maine or USS Nevada, if his intelligence reports were correct, would finish this patrol, refit, conduct another, refit again, then yet another patrol in February, which coincided with his deployment schedule after his overhaul. So the next time he was back, he'd be up against the same captain, and this one had made a mistake. After the refit, Admiral Lunin would be quieter and would have better sonar, and Dubunin was starting to wonder when he'd be able to play his game against the Americans. Wouldn't it be nice, he thought. All the time he'd spent to get here, the wonderful years learning his trade in Northern Fleet under Marco Ramius. What a pity for such a brilliant officer to have died in an accident. But duty at sea was dangerous, always had been, always would be. Marco had got his crew off before scuttling. Dubunin shook his head. Today he might have gotten an assist from the Americans. Might? Would have. Just as an American ship would get one from a Soviet. The changes in his country and the world made Dubunin feel much better about his job. It had always been a demanding game of skill, but its deadly purpose had changed. Oh yes, the American missile submarines still had their rockets pointed at his country, and Soviet rockets were pointed at America, but perhaps they would be gone soon. Until they were. He'd continue to do his job, and it seemed ironic indeed that just as the Soviet Navy was on the threshold of becoming competitive, the Akula class was roughly equal with an early Los Angeles class in a mechanical sense, the need for it was diminishing. Like a friendly game of cards, perhaps, he asked himself. Not a bad simile. Speed, Captain. Dubunin considered that. Assume a range of 20 nautical miles and a target speed of 5 knots. We'll do 7 knots, I think. That way we can remain very quiet and perhaps still catch him. Every 2 hours we'll turn to maximize the capacity of the sonar. Yes, that is the plan. Next time, Yevgeny, we'll have 2 new officer sonar operators to back you up. Dubunin reminded himself. The drawdown of the Soviet submarine force had released a lot of young officers who were now getting specialist training. The submarine's complement of officers would double, and even more than the new equipment. That would make a difference in his abilities to hunt. We blew it, Bunker said. I blew it. I gave the president bad advice. You're not the only one. Ryan admitted as he stretched. But was that scenario realistic? I mean, really realistic? It turned out that the whole thing had been a ploy by a hard-pressed Soviet leader trying to get control over his military, and doing so by making it look as though some renegades had taken action. Not likely, but possible. All things are possible,
Jack observed. What do you suppose their war games say about us?
Bunker laughed.
Nothing good, I'm sure. At the end, America had had to accept the loss of its cruiser, USS Valley Forge, in return for the Charlie-class submarine that USS Kidd's helicopter had found and sunk. That was not regarded as an even trade, rather like losing a rook to the other fellow's knight. Soviet forces had gone on alert in eastern Germany, and the weaker NATO forces had been unsure of their ability to deal with them. As a result, the Soviets had won a concession on the troop pullback schedule. Ryan thought the whole scenario contrived, but they often were, and the point in any case was to see how to manage an unlikely crisis. Here they had done badly, moving too rapidly in non-essential areas, and too slowly in the ones that mattered, but which had not been recognized in time. The lesson, as always, was, don't make mistakes. That was something known by any first grader, of course, and all men made mistakes. But the difference between a first grader and a senior official was that official mistakes carried far more weight. That fact was an entirely different lesson, and one often not learned.
Chapter 14. Revelation.
So, what have you found? He's a most interesting man, Goodley replied. He's done some things at CIA that are hardly believable.
I know about the submarine business, and the defection of the KGB head. What else? Liz Elliott asked.
He's rather well liked in the international intelligence community, like Sir Basil Charleston over in England.
Well, it's easy to see why they like him.
But the same is true in the NATO countries, especially in France. Ryan stumbled across something that enabled the DGSE to bag a bunch of Action Directe people, Goodley explained. He was somewhat uncomfortable with his role of designated informer. The National Security Advisor didn't like to be kept waiting, but there was no sense in pressing the young scholar, was there? Her face took on a wry smile.
Am I to assume that you have started admiring the man?
He's done fine work. But he's made his mistakes, too. His estimate on the fall of East Germany and the progress of reunification was way off. He had not managed to learn that everyone else was as well. Goodley himself had guessed almost exactly right on this issue up at the Kennedy School, and the paper he'd published in an obscure journal was something else that had earned him attention at the White House. The White House fellow stopped again.
And?
Elliot prodded. And there are some troubling aspects in his personal life.
Finally.
And those are? Ryan was investigated by the SEC for possible insider stock trading before he entered CIA employ. It seems there was a computer software company about to get a Navy contract. Ryan found out about it before anyone else and made a real killing. The SEC found out. The reason is that the company executives themselves were also investigated and examined Ryan's records. He got off on a technicality.
Explain, Liz ordered.
In order to cover their own backsides, the company officials arranged to have something published in a defense trade paper, just a little filler item, not even 2 column inches, but it was enough to show that the information upon which they and Ryan operated was technically in the public domain. That made it legal. What's more interesting is what Ryan did with the money after attention was called to it. He cut it out of his brokerage account. That's in a blind trust arrangement now with 4 different money managers.
Goodley stopped.
You know what Ryan's worth now?
No. What is it?
Over $15 million. He's by far the richest guy at the agency. His holdings are somewhat undervalued. I'd say he's worth closer to 20 myself, but he's been using the same accounting method since before he joined CIA, and you can't critique him there. How you figure net worth is kind of metaphysical, isn't it? Accountants have different ways of doing things. Anyway, what he did with that windfall, he split it off to a separate account.
Then a short while ago, it all moved out into an educational trust fund.
His kids?
No, Goodley answered. The beneficiaries. No, let me back up. He used part of the money to set up a convenience store, a 7-Eleven, for a widow and her children. The rest of the money is set aside in T-bills and a few blue-chip stocks to educate her children.
Who is she?
Her name is Carol Zimmer. Laotian by birth, she's the widow of an Air Force sergeant who got killed in a training accident. Ryan has been looking after the family. He even signed out of his office to attend the birth of the newest child. A girl, by the way. Ryan visits the family periodically, Goodley concluded.
I see.
She didn't, but that is what one says.
Any professional connection?
Not really. Mrs. Zimmer, as I said, was Laotian. Her father was one of those tribal chieftains that CIA supported against the North Vietnamese. The whole group was wiped out. I haven't discovered how she managed to escape. She married an Air Force sergeant and came to America. He died in an accident somewhere, rather recently. There is nothing in Ryan's file to show any previous connection to the family at all. The Laos connection is possible, to CIA, I mean, but Ryan wasn't in government employ then. He was an undergrad in college. There's nothing in the file to show a connection of any kind. Just one day, a few months before the last presidential election, he set up this trust fund, and ever since he visits them on the average of once a week. Oh, there was one other thing.
What's that?
I cross-referenced this from another file. There was some trouble at the 7-Eleven. Some local punks were bothering the Zimmer family. Ryan's principal bodyguard is a CIA officer named Clark. He used to be a field officer and now is a protective guy. I wasn't able to get his file, Goodley explained. Anyway, this Clark guy evidently assaulted a couple of gang kids, sent one to the hospital. I checked a newspaper clipping. It was in the news, a little item. Concerned citizen sort of thing. Clark and another CIA guy, the paper identified them as federal employees, no CIA connection, were supposedly accosted by four street toughs. This Clark guy must be a piece of work. The gang leader had his knee broken and was hospitalized. One other was just knocked unconscious, and the rest just stood there and wet their pants. The local cops treated it as a gang problem. Well, a former gang problem. No formal charges were pressed.
What else do you know about this Clark?
I've seen him a few times. Big guy, late 40s, quiet. Actually, seems kind of shy. But he moves. You know what he moves like? I took karate courses once. The instructor was a former Green Beret, Vietnam veteran, all that stuff. Like that. He moves like an athlete. Fluid, economical. But it's his eyes. They're always moving around. He looks at you sideways and decides if you're a threat or no threat. Goodley paused. At that moment, he realized what Clark really was. Whatever else he was, Ben Goodley was no fool. That is one dangerous guy.
What?
Liz Elliott didn't know what he was talking about. Excuse me. I learned that from the karate teacher up at Cambridge. The really dangerous ones don't seem dangerous. You just sort of lose track of them in the room. My teacher, he was mugged on the subway station right there by Harvard. I mean, they tried to mug him. He left three kids bleeding on the bricks. They thought he was just a janitor or something. He's an African-American, about 50 now, I guess. Looks like a janitor or something, the way he dresses. Not dangerous at all. That's what Clark is like. Just like my old sensei.
Interesting, Goodley said.
Well, he's a SPO, and they're supposed to be good at their job. I speculate that Ryan found out that some punks were bothering Mrs. Zimmer and had his bodyguard straighten things out. The Anne Arundel County Police thought it was just fine.
Conclusions?
Ryan has done some very good work, but he's blown some big ones, too. Fundamentally, he's a creature of the past.
He's still a Cold War guy. He's got problems with the administration, like a few days ago when you didn't attend the Camelot game. He doesn't think you take your job seriously, thinks that not playing those war games is irresponsible. He said that. Almost a direct quote. I was in the room with Cabot when he came in and bitched. Elliot shook her head. That's a cold warrior talking. If the president does his job right, and if I do my job right, there won't be any crises to manage. That's the whole point, isn't it? And so far, you guys seem to be doing all right, Goodley observed. The National Security Advisor ignored the remark, looking at her notes. The walls were in place and weather sealed with plastic sheeting. The air conditioning system was already running, removing both humidity and dust from the air. Frome was at work with the machine tool tables. Table was too pedestrian a term. They were designed to hold several tons each and had screw jacks on each sturdy leg. The German was leveling each machine with the aid of spirit levels built into the frames. Perfect, he said after 3 hours of work. It had to be perfect. Now it was. Under each table was a full meter of reinforced concrete footings. Once leveled, the legs were bolted into place so that each was a solid part of the earth.
The tools must be so rigid, Gone asked.
Frome shook his head.
Quite the reverse. The tools float on a cushion of air. But you said they weigh over a ton each, Cotty objected. Floating them on an air cushion is trivial. You've seen photographs of hovercraft weighing 100 tons. Floating them is necessary to dampen out vibrations from the earth.
What tolerances are we seeking? Gone asked.
Roughly what one needs for an astronomical telescope, the German replied. But the original bombs...
Frome cut Gone off.
The original American bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were crude embarrassments. They wasted almost all of their reaction mass, especially the Hiroshima weapon. You would not manufacture so crude a weapon any more than you would design a bomb with a burning gunpowder fuse, eh? In any case, you cannot use such a wasteful design, Frome went on. After the first bombs, the American engineers had to face the problem that they had limited supplies of fissile material. That few kilos of plutonium over there is the most expensive material in the world. The plant needed to make it through nuclear bombardment costs billions. Then comes the additional cost of separation, another plant, and another billion. Only America had the money to do the initial project. Everyone in the world knew about nuclear fission. It was no secret. What real secrets are there in physics, eh? But only America had the money and resources to make the attempt.
And the people, Frome added. What people they had.
So, the first bombs, they made 3, by the way, were designed to use all the available material, and because the main criterion was reliability, they were made to be crude but effective, and they required the largest aircraft in the world to carry them. Also, then, the war was won, and bomb design became a professional study and not a frantic wartime project, yeah? The plutonium reactor they have at Hanford turned out only a few tens of kilos of plutonium per year at the time, and the Americans had to learn to use the material more efficiently. The Mark 12 bomb was one of the first really advanced designs, and the Israelis improved it somewhat. That bomb has 5 times the yield of the Hiroshima device for less than a fifth of the reaction mass. 25-fold improvement in efficiency, yeah? And we can improve that by almost a factor of 10. Now, a really expert design team with the proper facilities could advance that by another factor of... perhaps 4. Modern warheads are the most elegant, the most fascinating... 2 megatons? Gone asked. Was it possible? We cannot do it here, Frome said, the sorrow manifest in his voice. The available information is insufficient. The physics are straightforward, but there are engineering concerns, and there are no published articles to aid us in the bomb design process. Remember that warhead tests are being carried out even today to make the bombs smaller and yet more efficient. One must experiment in this field as with any other, and we cannot experiment. Nor do we have the time or money to train technicians to execute the design. I could come up with a theoretical design for a megaton-plus device, but in truth it would have only a 50% likelihood of success. Perhaps a little more, but it would not be a practical undertaking without a proper experimental test program. What can you do? Kati asked. I can make this into a weapon with a nominal yield of between 400 and 500 kilotons. It will be roughly a cubic meter in size and weight roughly 500 kilos. Frome paused to read the looks on their faces. It will not be an elegant device, and it will be overly bulky and heavy. It will also be quite powerful. It would be far more clever in design than anything American or Russian technicians had managed in the first 15 years of the nuclear age, and that, Frome thought, wasn't bad at all. Explosive containment? Gon asked. Yes. This young Arab was very clever, Frome thought. The first bombs used massive steel cases. Ours will use explosives. Bulky, but light, and just as effective. We will squirt tritium into the core at the moment of ignition. As in the original Israeli design, that will generate large quantities of neutrons to boost the fission reaction. That reaction in turn will blast additional neutrons into another tritium supply, causing a fusion reaction. The energy budget is roughly 50 kilotons from the primary and 400 from the secondary.
How much tritium?
While not a difficult substance to obtain in small amounts, watchmakers and gunsight manufacturers used it, but only in microscopic quantities. Gon knew supplies over 10 milligrams were virtually unobtainable, as he had just discovered himself. Tritium, not plutonium despite what Frome had said, was the most expensive commercially available material on the planet. You could get tritium, but not plutonium.
I have 50 grams, Frome announced smugly. Far more than we can actually use.
50 grams, Gon explained. 50?
Our reactor complex was manufacturing special nuclear material for our own bomb project. When the socialist government fell, it was decided to give the plutonium to the Soviets. Loyalty to the world socialist cause, you see. The Soviets didn't see things that way. Their reaction, Frome paused. They called it... Well, I will leave that to your imagination. Their reaction was so strong that I decided to hide our tritium production. As you know, it is very valuable commercially. My insurance policy, you might call it.
Where?
In the basement of my home, concealed in some nickel-hydrogen batteries. Kati didn't like that, not one small bit. The Arab chieftain was not a well man, the German could see, and that did not help him conceal his feelings. I need to return to Germany in any case to get the machine tools, he said.
You have them?
5 kilometers from my home is the Karl Marx Astrophysical Institute. We were supposed to manufacture astronomical telescopes there, visual and X-ray telescopes. Alas, it never opened. Such a fine cover wasted, huh? In the machine shop, in crates marked astrophysical instruments, are 6 high-precision, 5-axis machines. The finest sort, Frome observed with a wolfish grin. Cincinnati Millicron, from the United States of America. Precisely what the Americans use at their Oak Ridge, Rocky Flats, and Pantex fabrication plants.
What about operators? Gon asked.
We were training 20 of them, 16 men and 4 women,
each with a university degree? No, that would be too dangerous. It is not really necessary in any case. The machines are user-friendly, as they say. We could do the work ourselves, but that would take too much time. Any skilled lensmaker, even a master gunsmith, as a matter of fact, can operate them. What was the business of Nobel Prize winners 50 years ago is now the work of a competent machinist, Fromm said. Such is the nature of progress. Yeah?
It could be. Then again, it could not, Yevgeny said. He'd been on duty for 20 hours straight, and only 6 hours of fitful sleep separated that from yet another, longer stint. Finding it, if that indeed was what they'd done, had taken all of Dubinin's skill. He'd guessed that the American missile sub had headed south, and that her cruising speed was on the order of 5 knots. Next came environmental considerations. He'd had to stay close, within direct path range, not allowing himself to come into a sonar convergence zone. The CZs were annular, donut-shaped areas around a vessel. Sound that went downward from a point within the convergence zone was refracted by the water temperature and pressure, traveling back and forth to the surface on a helical path at semi-regular intervals that in turn depended on environmental conditions. By staying out of them, relative to where he thought his target was, he could evade one means of detection. To do that meant that he had to stay within theoretical direct path distance, the area in which sound simply traveled radially from its source. To accomplish that without detection, he had to remain on the top side of the thermoclin layer. He figured that the American would remain under it, while allowing his towed array sonar to hang below it. In this way, his own engine plant noises would probably be deflected away from the American submarine. Dubyanin's tactical problem lay in his disadvantages. The American submarine was quieter than his, and possessed both better sonars and better sonar operators. Senior Lieutenant Yevgeny Nikolaevich Rykov was a very bright young officer, but he was the only sonar expert aboard who might fairly be matched against his American counterparts, and the boy was burning himself out. Captain Dubyanin's only advantage lay in himself. He was a fine tactician, and knew it. And his American counterpart was not, Dubyanin thought, and didn't know it. There was a final disadvantage. By staying on top of the layer, he made counter-detection by an American patrol aircraft easier, but Dubyanin was willing to run that risk. What lay before him was a prize such as no Russian submarine commander had ever grasped. Both captain and lieutenant stared at a waterfall display, looking not at a strobe of light, but instead a disjointed, barely visible vertical line that wasn't as bright as it should have been. The American Ohio class was quieter than the background noise of the ocean, and both men wondered if somehow environmental conditions were showing them the acoustical shadow of that most sophisticated of missile submarines. It was just as likely, Dubyanin thought, that fatigue was playing hallucinatory games with both of their minds.
"We need a transient," Rykov said, reaching for his tea. "A dropped tool, a slammed hatch. A mistake, a mistake. I could ping him. I could duck below the layer and hit him with a blast of active sonar energy and find out." "No." Dubyanin turned away and nearly swore at himself. "Patience, Valentin. They are patient. We must be patient. Yevgeny Nikolaevich, you look weary. I can rest in Petropavlovsk, Captain. I will sleep for a week and see my wife. Well, I will not sleep entirely for that week," he said with an exhausted grin. The lieutenant's face was illuminated by the yellow glow of the screen. "But I will not turn away from a chance like this one. There will be no accidental transients. I know, Captain. Those damned American crews. I know it's him. I know it's an Ohio. What else could it be? Imagination, Yevgeny. Imagination and too large a wish on our part." Lieutenant Rykov turned.
I think my captain knows better than that. I think my lieutenant is right. Such a game this is. Ship against ship, mind against mind. Chess in three dimensions, played in an ever-changing physical environment. And the Americans were the masters of the game. Dubyanin knew that. Better equipment, better crews, better training. Of course, the Americans knew that, too. And two generations of advantage had generated arrogance rather than innovation. Not in all, but certainly in some. A clever commander in the missile submarine would be doing things differently. If I had such a submarine, not all the world could find me.
12 more hours, then we must break contact and turn for home.
Too bad, Rykov observed, not meaning it. 6 weeks at sea was enough for him.
Make your depth 60 feet, the officer of the deck said.
Make my depth 60 feet, aye, the diving officer replied. 10 degrees up on the Fairwater Plains. The missile firing drill had just begun. A regular occurrence, it was intended both to ensure the competence of the crew and desensitize them to their primary warfighting mission, the launch of 24 UGM-93 Trident II D-5 missiles, each with 10 Mark V re-entry vehicles of 400 kilotons nominal yield. A total of 240 warheads with a total net yield of 96 megatons. But there was more to it than that, since nuclear weapons depended on the interlocking logic of several physical laws. Small weapons employed their yield with greater efficiencies than larger ones. Most important of all, the Mark V RV had a demonstrated accuracy of plus or minus 50 meters CEP, circular error probable. Meaning that after a flight of over 4,000 nautical miles, half the warheads would land within 164.041 feet of their targets, and nearly all the rest within 300 feet. The miss distance was far smaller than the crater to be expected from such a warhead, as a result of which the D-5 missile was the first sea-launched ballistic missile with counterforce capability. It was designed for a disarming first strike. Given the normal 2-at-1 targeting, Maine could eliminate 120 Soviet missiles and or missile control bunkers, roughly 10% of the current Soviet ICBM force, which was itself configured for a counterforce mission. In the Missile Control Center, MCC, aft of the cavernous missile room, a senior chief petty officer lit up his panel. All 24 birds were online. Onboard navigation equipment fed data into each missile guidance system. It would be updated in a few minutes from orbiting navigation satellites. To hit a target, the missile had to know not only where the target was, but also where the missile itself was starting from. The Navstar global positioning system could do that with a tolerance of less than 5 meters. The senior chief watched status lights change as missiles were interrogated by his computers, and reported their readiness. Around the submarine, water pressure on the hull diminished at a rate of 2.2 tons per square foot for every 100 feet of rise toward the surface. Maine's hull expanded slightly as the pressure was relieved, and there was a tiny amount of noise as steel relaxed from the compression. It was only a groan. Scarcely audible even over the sonar systems and seductively close to the call of a whale. Rykov was so drunk with fatigue that had it come a few minutes later he would have missed it. But though his daydreams were getting the best of him, his mind retained enough of its sharpness to take note of the sound.
Captain, hull popping noise, right there.
His finger stabbed the screen, just at the bottom of the shadow he and Dubyanin had been examining.
He's coming shallow.
Dubyanin raced into the control room.
Stand by to change depth.
He put on a headset that connected him to Lieutenant Rykov.
Yevgeny Nikolaevich, this must be done well and done quickly. I will drop below the layer just as the American goes over it.
No, Captain, you can wait. His array will hang below briefly as ours would do.
Damn. Dubyanin almost laughed. Forgive me, Lieutenant. For that,
a bottle of Starka, which was the best Russian-made vodka.
My wife and I will drink your health. I'm getting an angle reading. Estimate target 5 degrees depression from our array. Captain, if I can hold him, the moment we lose him through the layer...
Yes. A quick range estimate. It would be crude, but it would be something. Dubinin rasped quick orders to his tracking officer.
2 degrees. Hull noises are gone. This is very hard to hold, but he's occulting the background a little more now. Gone. He's through the layer now.
1, 2, 3, Dubinin counted. The American must be doing a missile drill or coming up to receive communications. In any case, he'd go to 20 meters depth and his towed array, 500 meters along, speed 5 knots, and... Now. Helm, down 5 degrees on the bow planes. We're going just below the layer. Starpom, make note of outside water temperature.
Gently, Helm, gently.
Admiral Lunin dipped her bow and slid below the undulating border that marked the difference between relatively warm surface water and colder deep water.
Range? Dubinin asked his tracking officer.
Estimate between 5 and 9,000 meters, Captain. Best I can do with the data.
Well done, Kolya. Splendid.
We're below the layer now. Water temperature down 5 degrees, the Starpom called.
Bow planes to zero. Level out.
Planes to zero, Captain. Zero angle on the boat.
Had there been enough overhead room, Dubinin would have leaped off his feet. He'd just done what no other Soviet submarine commander, and if his intelligence information was right, only a handful of Americans had ever done. He'd established contact with and tracked an American Ohio-class fleet ballistic missile submarine. In a war situation, he'd be able to fire off ranging pings with his active sonar and launch torpedoes. He'd stalked the world's most elusive game and was close enough for a killing shot. His skin tingled from the excitement of the moment. Nothing in the world could match this feeling. Nothing at all.
Real ne bravo, he said next. Right rudder, new course 300. Increase speed slowly to 10 knots.
But, Captain, his Starpom, executive officer said, we're breaking contact. He'll continue this drill for at least 30 minutes. It is very unlikely that we can evade counter-detection when he concludes it. Better to leave now. We do not want him to know what we have done. We will meet this one again. In any case, our mission is accomplished. We have tracked him, and we got close enough to launch our attack. At Petropavlovsk, men, there will be much drinking, and your captain will do the buying. Now let's clear the area quietly, so that he will not know that we were ever here.
Captain Robert Jefferson Jackson wished he was younger, wished that his hair was still completely black, that he could again be a young nugget fresh from Pensacola, ready to take his first hop in one of the forbidding fighter aircraft that sat like enormous birds of prey along the flight line at Oceana Naval Air Station. That all 24 of the F-14D Tomcats in the immediate area were his was not as satisfying as the knowledge that one was his and his alone. Instead, as Commander Air Group, he owned 2 Tomcat squadrons, 2 more of FA-18 Hornets, 1 of A-6E intruder medium attack aircraft, another of S-3 submarine hunters, and finally the less glamorous tankers, electronic warfare prowlers, and rescue ASW helicopters. A total of 78 birds with an aggregate value of what? $1 billion? Much more if you considered replacement cost. Then there were the 3,000 men who flew and serviced the aircraft, each of whom was beyond price, of course. He was responsible for all of it. It was much more fun to be a new fighter pilot who drove his personal airplane and left the worrying to management. Robbie was now management, the guy the kids talked about in their cabins on the ship. They didn't want to be called into his office because that was like going to see the principal.
They didn't really like flying with him because A, he was too old to be good at it anymore, they thought, and B, he'd tell them whatever he thought they were doing wrong. Fighter pilots do not often admit mistakes, except among themselves. There was a certain irony to it. His previous job had been in the Pentagon, pushing papers. He'd prayed and lusted for release from that job, whose main excitement every day was finding a decent parking spot. Then he'd gotten command of his air wing, and been stuck with more admin crap than he'd ever faced in his life. At least he got to fly twice a week, if he was lucky. Today was such a day. His command master chief petty officer gave him a grin on the way out the door.
Mind the store, Master Chief.
Roger that, Skipper. It'll be here when you get back. Jackson stopped in his tracks.
You can have someone steal all the paperwork.
I'll see what I can do, sir.
A staff car took him to the flight line. Jackson was already in his Nomex flight suit, an old smelly one whose olive drab color was faded from many washings and threadbare at the elbows and seat from years of use. He could and should have gotten a new one, but pilots are superstitious creatures. Robbie and this flight suit had been through a lot together.
"Hey, Skipper," called one of his squadron commanders.
Commander Bud Sanchez was shorter than Jackson. His olive skin and Bismarck mustache accentuated bright eyes and a grin right out of a toothpaste commercial. Sanchez, commanding officer of VF-1, would fly Jackson's wing today. They'd flown together when Jackson had commanded VF-41 off the John F. Kennedy.
"Your bird is all dialed in. Ready to kick a little ass?"
"Who's the opposition today?"
"Some jarheads out of Cherry Point in 18 Deltas. We got a Hummer already orbiting 100 miles out, and the exercise is bar cap against low-level intruders."
Bar cap meant Barrier Combat Air Patrol. The mission was to prevent attacking aircraft from crossing a line that they were not supposed to cross.
"Up to some heavy ACM? Those Marines sounded a little cocky over the phone."
"The Marine I can't take ain't been born yet," Robbie said as he pulled his helmet off the rack. It bore his call sign, Spade.
"Hey, you RIOs," Sanchez called. "Quit holding hands and let's get it on."
"On the way, bud." Michael Lobo Alexander came from around the lockers, followed by Jackson's radar intercept officer, Henry Shredder Walters. Both were under 30, both lieutenants. In the locker room, people talked by call sign rather than rank. Robbie loved the fellowship of squadron life as much as he loved his country. Outside, the plane captains, petty officers, who were responsible for maintaining the aircraft, walked the officers to their respective birds and helped them aboard. On the dangerous area of a carrier flight deck, pilots are led virtually by the hand by enlisted men, lest they get lost or hurt. Jackson's bird had a 00 ID number on the nose. Under the cockpit was painted, "Captain R.J. Jackson, Spade," to make sure that everyone knew that this was the CAG's bird. Under that was a flag representing a MiG-29 fighter aircraft that an Iraqi had mistakenly flown too close to Jackson's Tomcat not so long before. There hadn't been much to it. The other pilot had forgotten, once, to check his six and paid the price. But a kill was a kill, and kills were what fighter pilots lived for. 5 minutes later, all four men were strapped in, and engines were turning.
"How are you this morning, Shredder?" Jackson asked over his intercom.
"Ready to waste some Marines, Skipper. Looking good back here. Is this thing gonna fly today?"
"Guess it's time to find out."
Jackson switched to radio.
"Bud, this is Spade. Ready here."
"Roger, Spade. You have the lead."
Both pilots looked around, got an all clear from their plane captains, and looked around again.
"Spade has the lead."
Jackson tripped his brakes.
"Rolling now."
"Hello, mein Schatz," Manfred Fromm said to his wife. Traudel rushed forward to embrace him.
"Where have you been?"
"That I cannot say," Fromm replied with a knowing twinkle in his eye. He hummed a few bars from Lloyd Webber's "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina."
"I knew you would see."
Traudel beamed at him.
You must not talk of this.
To confirm her suspicion, he handed her a wad of banknotes, 5 packets of 10,000 D-marks each.
That should keep the mercenary bitch quiet and happy, Manfred Fromm told himself. And I will only be here overnight. I had some business to do, and
of course, Manfred. She hugged him again, the money in her hands.
If only you had called.
Arrangements had been absurdly easy to make. A ship outbound for Latakia, Syria, was sailing from Rotterdam in 70 hours. He and Bach had arranged for a commercial trucking company to load the machine tools into a small cargo container, which would be loaded on the ship and unloaded onto a Syrian dock in 6 more days. It would have been faster to send the tools by air, or even by rail to a Greek or Italian port for faster transshipment by sea, but Rotterdam was the world's busiest port, with overworked customs officials whose main task was searching for drug shipments. Sniffer dogs could go over that particular container to their heart's content. Fromm let his wife go into the kitchen to make coffee. It would take a few minutes, and that was all he needed. He walked down into his basement. In the corner, as far from the water heater as was possible, was an orderly pile of lumber, on top of which were 4 black metal boxes. Each weighed about 10 kilograms, about 25 pounds. Fromm carried one at a time. On the second trip, he got a pair of gloves from his bureau drawer to protect his hands and placed them in the trunk of his rented BMW. By the time the coffee was ready, his task was complete.
You have a fine tan, Traddle observed, carrying the tray out from the kitchen. In her mind, she'd already spent about 1/4 of the money her husband had given her. So Manfred had seen the light. She'd known he would sooner or later. Better that it should be sooner. She'd be especially nice to him tonight.
Gunther? Bach didn't like leaving Fromm to his own devices, but he also had a task to perform. This was a far greater risk. It was, he told himself, a high-risk operational concept, even if the real dangers were in the planning stage, which was both an oddity and a relief. Irvin Keitel lived on a pension, and not an especially comfortable one at that. Its necessity came from 2 facts. First, he was a former lieutenant colonel in the East German Stasi, the intelligence and counterintelligence arm of the defunct German Democratic Republic. Second, he had liked his work of 32 years. Whereas most of his former colleagues had acknowledged the changes in their country and for the most part put their German identity ahead of whatever ideology they'd once held, and told literally everything they knew to the Bundesnachrichtendienst, Keitel had decided that he was not going to work for capitalists. That made him one of the politically unemployed citizens of the United Germany. His pension was a matter of convenience. The new German government honored, after a fashion, pre-existing government obligations. It was at the least politically expedient, and what Germany now was a matter of daily struggling with facts that were not and could not be reconciled. It was easier to give Keitel a pension than to leave him on the official dole, which was deemed more demeaning than a pension. By the government, that is. Keitel didn't see things quite that way. If the world made any sense at all, he thought, he would have been executed or exiled. Exactly where he might have been exiled to, Keitel didn't know. He'd begun to consider going over to the Russians. He'd had good contacts in the KGB, but that thought had died a quick death. The Soviets had washed their hands of everything to do with the DDR, fearing treachery from people whose allegiance to world socialism, or whatever the hell the Russians stood for now, Keitel had no idea, was somewhat less than their allegiance to their new country. Keitel took his seat beside Bach in the corner booth of a quiet Gasthaus in what had formerly been East Berlin.
This is very dangerous, my friend.
I am aware of that, Irvin. Bach waved for 2-liter glasses of beer. Service was quicker than it had been a few years before, but both men ignored that.
I cannot tell you how I feel about what they did to Petra, Keitel said after the girl left them.
Do you know exactly what happened? Bach asked in a level and emotionless voice.
The detective who ran the case visited her in prison. He did so quite often, not for interrogation. They made a conscious effort to push her over the edge.
You must understand, Gunther. Courage in a man or a woman is a finite quality. It was not weakness on her part. Anyone can break. It is simply a matter of time.
They watched her die, the retired colonel said.
Oh. Bach's face didn't change, but his knuckles went white on the Stein handle.
There was a television camera hidden in her cell. They have her suicide on videotape. They watched her do it and did nothing to stop her.
Bach didn't say anything, and the room was too dim to see how pale his face went. It was as though a hot blast from a furnace swept over him, followed by one from the North Pole. He closed his eyes for a brief second to get control of himself. Petra would not have wished him to be governed by emotion at a time like this. He opened his eyes to look at his friend.
Is that the fact? I know the name of the detective. I know his address. I still have friends, Keitel assured Bach.
Yes, Irvin. I am sure you do. I need your help to do something.
Anything.
You know, of course, what brought us to this.
That depends on how you mean it, Keitel said. The people disappointed me in the way they allowed themselves to be seduced, but the common people always lack the discipline to know what is good for them. The real cause of our national misfortune...
Precisely. The Americans and the Russians.
Mein lieber Gunther, even a united Germany cannot...
Yes, it can. If we are to remake the world into our image, Irvin, both of our oppressors must be damaged severely.
But how?
There is a way. Can you believe me that much? Just for now. Keitel drained his beer and sat back. He'd helped train Bach. At 56, it was too late for him to change his ideas of the world, and he was still a fine judge of character. Bach was a man such as himself. Gunther had been a careful, ruthless, and very effective clandestine operator.
What of our detective friend?
Bach shook his head. As much satisfaction as that might give me. No. This is not a time for personal revenge. We have a movement and a country to save.
More than one, in fact,
Bach thought. But this was not the time for that. What was taking shape in his mind was a grand stroke, a breathtaking maneuver that might, he was too intellectually honest to say would, even to himself, change the world into a more malleable shape. Exactly what would happen after that, who could say? That would not matter at all if he and his friends were unable to take the first bold step.
How long have we known each other? 15 years? 20?
Keitel smiled.
Aber natürlich. Of course I can trust you.
How many others can we trust?
How many do we need?
No more than 10, but we will need a total of 10. Keitel's face went blank.
8 men we can trust absolutely? That is too many for safety, Gunther. What sort of men?
Bach told him.
I know where to start. It should be possible. Men of my age, and some younger of your age. The physical skills you require are not difficult to obtain, but remember that much of this is beyond our control.
as some of my friends say. That is in God's hands, Gunther said with a smirk. Barbarians,